then a perturbation which we quantize. The perturbation depends on x and the time. We also write it as delta phi. Same thing, just another name for it. Whereas the phi naught depends only on time. Okay, so the phi hat is to be quantized. Now, for the metric, we do a very similar thing. We write the metric as a metric that does not depend on space. This we will treat classically, and a perturbation, which is assumed small, which we will quantize. So we will actually look for quantum fluctuations also of gravity itself. Now, the perturbations of the metric can be decomposed into scalar, vector, and tensor type fluctuations. And for that purpose, we expressed gamma mu nu in terms of derivatives of scalars, of vectors, and just tensors. So ultimately, the gamma is always dependent on some scalar functions, E, V, psi, and phi, some vector-valued functions, V and W, and the rest, which is purely tensorial. Now, it turns out that one can slice space-time in such a way and choose coordinate system in such a way that those functions vanish except for psi and for hij. Hij being the purely tensorial part and psi being a purely scalar part. Then we notice that the fluctuations in the inflaton field, which in principle are their own degree of freedom, obey their own equation of motion, and the fluctuations, the scalar fluctuations of the metric psi, which in principle looks like its own degree of freedom, really only constitute one degree of freedom because they are coupled through the Einstein equation. It's just to say that if the inflaton field fluctuates, that will induce a fluctuation in the energy momentum tensor, which will induce a fluctuation in the curvature, and it's in fact a fluctuation in psi, and vice versa, if you want to read it the other way around. So those two degrees of freedom, the scalar part of the metric and the inflaton's fluctuations, are really just one degree of freedom because they're coupled. And then, even though we didn't derive it, we stated already that this combined degree of freedom made out of the two is this variable here, this field, R of x and eta. It consists of the fluctuations of the metric and the fluctuations of the inflaton field. But then, what exactly is this thing? What exactly is this degree of freedom, R of x and eta? The combination of the fluctuations of the inflaton field and the fluctuations of the scalar part of the metric. But as I said, psi is the scalar metric's fluctuation, inhomogeneities in the scalar part of the metric. And the second term, this one here, is really just the fluctuations, the perturbations of the inflaton field, phi, little phi of x and eta, decorated with some prefactors here, a prime over a, phi prime naught. Known functions, but still a complicated mess. Nevertheless, why on earth would we have to decorate this in this way? Now, you can imagine that intuitively, a fluctuation in the metric and the fluctuation in inflaton field might even have different units. So we shouldn't just be able to add them to get a combined degree of freedom. But why is it that we have to add them in this particular fashion, that we have to have an A prime over A as well? When obviously these two guys have the same units, so as far as the units is concerned, that will drop out. But why do we have that stuff as well? Why is this the prefactor that we have to do, that we have to use in order to get a degree of freedom that is not just the scalar field fluctuating, not just the metric fluctuating, but a combination of the two? Well, in order to see what this degree of freedom really means, it is useful to consider two choices, two particular choices out of infinitely many choices, two particular choices for slicing space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. There are two particular choices for how to define the time variable that will be very useful. Remember, choosing a slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces is the same as choosing a time variable, right? Because obviously, when we do a slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, then each space-like hypersurface is a surface of what we will call equal time. One choice that's very useful when we try to understand this equation here is to foliate space-time in such a way that on those space-like hypersurfaces of equal time, one has that the perturbation of the inflaton field is zero. Okay, so here the idea is this. Whenever there would be, let's say we start with an arbitrary coordinate system, and we see, not chosen with respect to any particular preference, and we see that there's a fluctuation in the inflaton field, and what we do is we simply change our slicing of the space-time a little bit around that fluctuation, so that on our new space, on our new foliation of space-time, whenever we go along one of those space-like hypersurfaces, we're really going along values of constant phi. So constant phi values are constant time values. This is in principle going to give us a good choice of space-like hypersurfaces, but it's not always possible to do this. Remember that we're dealing here with slow roll inflation, which means that the field phi will start out at some value, which means that it has, which is such that its potential is elevated, and then the field phi will change its value so that the potential value drops down. So during slow roll inflation, the value of phi, the value of the inflaton field is slowly decaying, or slowly changing. It might go up, might go down. It depends on what the potential looks like, whether the hill of the potential is to the left or to the right. But in any case, during slow roll inflation, the value of the inflaton field is changing slowly. And that means that we can use it as a time variable, right? Because it's changing during the evolution. So all those points of equal phi will be called points of equal time. And that gives us a slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. And during slow roll inflation, the inflaton field is not going to be rolling down that potential everywhere at the same rate, because the inflaton field has fluctuations. At some point, it might fluctuate to be a little bit large. At some point, it might fluctuate to be a little bit smaller. And this means that when, during realistic inflation, we choose our space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that they account for those fluctuations of the inflaton field, then you can think of this foliation as being a little bit wiggly. You know, it compensates for the fluctuations of the inflaton field so that as we go along one of those space-like hypersurfaces, the inflaton field is always constant. We go around those fluctuations. We move always along a surface of equal phi value. This is not always possible to do in arbitrary cosmological scenarios. And the reason is that it may not be unique. Consider the case of the sitter space. In the sitter space, the phi field always has a constant value. You see, it's not slowly rolling. The value of phi, the value of the potential is not changing. It's a cosmologically constant. So phi would be constant, and then you would have too many points of equal phi. Because without quantum fluctuations, they're everywhere in space. And always phi has the same value. So you couldn't do it. Now, remember, we will be dealing with slow roll inflation. We will not encounter that problem. But we should keep in mind from this definition that if we approach the special case of the sitter inflation, we should be running in trouble with this definition. Because that definition requires that phi overall is changing during the slow roll. As the potential changes, the phi changes, and we rely on that because we use phi as a time variable. All right, so if we do this, if we slice space-time in such a way that the inflaton field has no perturbations as we go along the space-like hypersurface, if the inflaton field is constant on any one of those hypersurfaces, and the next hypersurface has a different value of phi, but constant along the hypersurface. If we do this, then, well, the little phi, the fluctuation of the inflaton field at zero, this thing is absent. So this is to say that if we choose this coordinate system, if we choose this foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, then this variable r is really nothing but that. So in this coordinate system, it would look like the only thing that's fluctuating is psi. The only thing that's fluctuating is the metric. In other words, the only thing that's fluctuating is the curvature. Okay. So we see in this case, we see that in this case, r of x and eta expresses now purely metric fluctuations. There are no fluctuations in the inflaton field. Because in our coordinate system, you know, phi is just constant at every time. And from time to time it changes, but on a space-like hypersurface of equal time, phi is constant. So r of x and eta expresses some kind of curvature fluctuations, therefore. And technically, these curvature fluctuations, these fluctuations in the scalar part of the metric, are what is called intrinsic curvature fluctuations. You can visualize this as a local bloating, as a local fluctuation in the scale factor, if you like. Now, that's not the only way we can foliate space-time. We can foliate space-time in many other ways, too. And here's another extreme way of foliating space-time that's also quite enlightening. Our aim being, again, to get an impression on what this r is, this variable. We just found out that if we choose the space-like hypersurfaces such that they are equal phi, then this term drops out, and all of the fluctuations in R are really curvature fluctuations, intrinsic curvature fluctuations, local bloating, so to speak. Now, on the other hand, we can also foliate our space-time in such a way that the surfaces of equal, the space-like hypersurfaces of equal time eta are such that psi is equal to zero, constant, so that there are no fluctuations in the curvature. Now, the strategy is that we look at the space-time, and then whenever it looks like there is a fluctuation in curvature, we just choose our space-like hypersurfaces to go around that, so that the psi field, curvature field is just constant. So now when we go along a space-like hypersurface, it looks like there's only inflaton field fluctuations, no fluctuations in the metric, only fluctuations in the inflaton field by choice of coordinate system, which is also called by choice of gauge.
Why is it that
you're getting to that? I haven't explained yet why that would be good. But in this case, we notice that that term is absent. Okay, so now all the fluctuations in this variable, all the fluctuations are due to this business here, not to that. So it's only inflaton fluctuations. But why is it that the inflaton fluctuations have to come with these prefactors? Well, logically, the prefactors have to be such that the fluctuations in the inflaton can account for this local bloating that this one expresses. So let's see whether we can get that. So why does the contribution of the inflaton field in R of x and eta take this particular form? Well, the answer is this. The inflaton's inhomogeneities imply locally varying expansion rates. So the Hubble parameter, A prime over A, is locally varying. That's what this local bloating would mean. But now changing the space-time slicing from option A, so along the fluctuations of phi, to option B, which is along the fluctuations of the metric, this change of coordinate system that we just discussed has to turn pure intrinsic curvature fluctuations namely this local bloating, into pure inflaton fluctuations phi. So I will not go into the exact details of the differential geometry. Let's just see with the back of the envelope argument why it is that the prefactors for the phi field that we were wondering about produce this local bloating. So consider a fluctuation in the scale factor. So A, the scale factor, has to be thought of now not as a function of time, but as a function of space and time. Okay? Because that's what it means that you have a local bloating, more or less. So you have an expansion that is not homogeneous, but an expansion that, because of fluctuations, is at some places a little bit ahead, at some places a little bit behind. So the delta A is really delta A of x and eta. Okay, delta A of x and eta. So that's the fluctuation of the Hubble factor. Now we can write delta A over A as 1 over A. And then by the chain rule, it's delta A by delta phi, delta phi. You see, the value of phi is going to, it's connected to the expansion rate. So we can differentiate the expansion with respect to phi. Well, use the chain rule to express delta A as delta A by d phi d phi. But then the inflaton field phi depends on time. So we can use the chain rule again, and we write it as delta A by d eta by d phi d phi. Okay? Same thing as that. It's only that I use the chain rule to write it as A of eta, eta of phi. Keep in mind that this eta here is the dependence on, well, here I'm writing eta as a function of phi, but we could also write phi as a function of eta, of course. It would be just same thing, just inverse. Okay, now this we can write as 1 over a prime, so it's really a prime over a, and then the eta by d phi is the same as 1 over d phi by d eta, that would be phi prime, and delta phi here. So that is exactly the prefactor that we were wondering about up here, this one. You know, so this makes it plausible why we need these prefactors here, so that this accounts for local bloating the same way that that does. So what are the consequences then? Well, the intrinsic curvature inhomogeneity is these, and usually in the literature you will find R as being referred to as the intrinsic curvature inhomogeneity. But what you've just seen is that R describes the intrinsic curvature inhomogeneity if you choose your space-like hypersurfaces such that they are at constant phi. And I'll explain to you in a moment why, nevertheless, people usually speak of R as the intrinsic curvature, even though it's not always. It depends. You could choose a coordinate system in which it is not, in which a coordinate system in which it's all inflaton fluctuations, right? Okay, so one ramification of the calculation, the little calculation that we just did, is this. The intrinsic curvature inhomogeneities can actually become very strongly enhanced, it seems. And that's because we have this thing in the denominator here. You see, namely, as it happens, for close to the sitter inflation, and that should raise red flags, close to the sitter inflation, we have that phi naught prime is very small, because this is the rate of change of the inflaton field. But remember that in the de Sitter case, the cosmological constant is a constant. So in the de Sitter case, V of phi, the potential which plays the role of the cosmological constant, is constant. But if V of phi is constant, then phi is constant. And if phi is constant, then phi prime is zero, or very, very close to it. So that means that if we're looking at inflation approaching true exponential behavior, then the whole thing would seem to break down. Not only would seem to, it does break down. Because you would have an infinity over here. You can also look at it this way. If the exponential expansion, if the expansion during inflation is really exponential, then it means that A prime over A is constant. But that means that phi is constant, and that means that phi prime is about zero. And remember, we found previously that the Hubble constant is the square root of the potential. So if the Hubble constant is a constant, if the Hubble parameter is a constant, then the potential is a constant, therefore phi is a constant. So that would be zero, and that would blow this thing up. Why is this happening? Why is the sitter such a bad case here? Well, remember, as we discussed, the definition of R can be interpreted in two ways. Either you slice space-time in such a way that you go along surfaces of equal phi, or you go along hypersurfaces of equal curvature. But we said that this is really only possible, this freedom, you have this gauge freedom, this coordinate system independent, only if phi overall, if the inflaton field overall is changing in value over time. Because choosing space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that each of them has a fixed value of time, but a fixed value of phi means that the phi variable is a proxy of the time variable. It is just up to some transformation, some simple function. The phi variable is the same as the time variable. But if phi is not changing, as in the case of the sitter, then you can't use it as a time variable. This is just going through this little back of the envelope calculations again. Here's this local bloating calculation. Remember, we wrote it in this way. And the eta by d phi is the critical thing here. If phi is not changing over time, then d phi by d eta would be very small, or zero, and then the inverse of it would be very large. So if phi prime, d phi by d zero is very small, then the eta by d phi would be very large. But this would be bad for two reasons. First of all, we assume that the fluctuations are small. And secondly, we assumed that we can choose space-like hypersurfaces such that they are of equal phi value. And both of these things would fail in this case. If we are close to the sitter, then the eta by d phi would be large. And intuitively, this means that the time lag between slicing space-time one way or slicing space-time the other way, cases A and B, the difference in the time coordinate that you would choose in order to either go around the fluctuation this way or that way, that difference, that time lag, would be very large. Too large to be able to treat this perturbatively. So could this be a problem in practice for cosmology? In principle, it could be. But then observations save us. We know that the size of the fluctuations of the in the cosmic microwave background is not all that big. It's only of the order of 10 to the minus 5. So roughly speaking, the observations tell us already that this is not going to be big. And therefore, this we should be in the range of parameter values in which perturbation theory is valid. On top of that, there is already evidence from precision measurements of the cosmic microwave background that that slow roll really happened. That during inflation, the potential was not constant. See, if during inflation the potential had been constant, then it would have meant that the Hubble constant would have been constant, Hubble parameter would have been constant. It would have meant that the Hubble radius is a constant during inflation. And that would have meant that when modes cross the Hubble horizon, stop oscillating and freeze their amplitude, it would have happened for each mode at the same wavelength. So their amplitudes would have been frozen at the same wavelength. And this means that all modes would have the same amplitude of fluctuations frozen in, whether they cross the horizon early or cross the horizon late. They always have the same amplitude frozen in. So that would have been a completely flat spectrum in the CMB, or in whatever caused the CMB. And the experimental evidence is already there to show that those modes which cross the Hubble horizon later actually have a little bit less power. They have a little bit smaller fluctuations. And that's because they crossed the Hubble horizon when the Hubble horizon was a little bit larger. So they had already dropped their fluctuation amplitude a little bit. So all of this is saying that we are not too close to the sitter, because the Hubble parameter actually was not constant at all. It did fall. We did have some slow roll. And on top of that, the fluctuations, in any case, are very small, only dealing with perturbations of order 10 to the minus 5. So we should be fine doing those calculations. But then there's another important question that I think needs clarification. Namely, is there a preferred slicing of space-time? Is it better, is it truer to slice space-time according to slicing A, or is it better, truer, closer to reality, so to speak, to slice space-time another way, the way B? Should we call those, is there any reason to make a preferred foliation of space-time? Well, the answer, of course, has to be that during inflation, there is no reason to prefer one over the other. It is a mere choice of coordinates, whether you want to do it this way or another way, whether you want to view your fluctuations as being fluctuations of intrinsic curvature, or you want to view them as fluctuations in the inflaton field, or any mix of the two, you can do it. Just choose your space-like hypersurfaces accordingly, and you will get them as a mix, or only the one, or only the other. But it turns out that ultimately there is a preference, but not during inflation, after inflation. It's at the end point of inflation. At the end point of inflation, it matters. And one particular slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces is preferred then. And the reason is that the point when inflation ends is the point when the value of the inflaton field drops down. You see, it's a slow roll, slow roll, slow roll, and then drops down. This is the point when all the energy is turned into the production of particles, etc. And when this point is reached, it depends on where you are in space-time, right? Because the inflaton field is not everywhere the same, and it fluctuates a little bit. So some point of space-time might reach that earlier, and another one might reach it later. But in any case, wherever inflation ends, it always ends when the inflaton field drops down in value, when the potential of the inflaton field drops down. Which is to say that the trigger for ending inflation is the inflaton field, not the intrinsic curvature. Okay? So that means that that there's a preferred slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, such that the space-like hypersurface at which the inflation ends is a surface of equal phi. The surface of equal phi, namely that value of phi where the potential drops. Okay? So that means that inflation ends on a space-like hypersurface of equal time, which is of equal phi value. And that means that at that point, it's really physically sensible to speak of all the fluctuations as being due to intrinsic curvature, because you've held all phi values fixed. So all the fluctuations in this choice of coordinate system, all the fluctuations are due to fluctuations in intrinsic curvature, because you've made sure that phi is constant.
But how does the fluctuation in phi dropping lead to the potential dropping?
Phi overall is slowly rolling, right? So the value of phi is changing, so that the potential is slowly going down. And then eventually it goes down and to its minimum. Okay, inflation ends. And this inflation doesn't end just everywhere simultaneously automatically, because there are fluctuations in the inflaton field. And what I'm saying is that it ends everywhere where the phi field just crosses that threshold. And that means that the space-like hypersurface of ending of inflation is a space-like hypersurface of a fixed value phi. And that means that if you go along a space like outer surface, the phi values are always the same. So the only thing that can fluctuate is the intrinsic curvature.
And what is it?
And for that reason, R is often mostly spoken of as the intrinsic curvature. But that's because physically it's singled out at the end of inflation, not during inflation. Okay? Now we have to quantize that.
And what is the threshold? Like,
well, it depends on the potential. Let's say, remember we had one, a classic plot for inflation would be that the potential V of phi is phi, and then the potential might be looking like this, something like that. So you would have that the impact on field might start out somewhere here, for example, for a very small value of phi, it's here, and then the dynamics takes it this way, and as it hits those Niagara Falls here, it will fall down very quickly then, okay? So here we have the slow roll period. The value of the phi field increases, 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 up until about here, which is the phi of the threshold or so. This is where all this energy gets turned into the, this should be drawn like that. This here is where the energy is turned into the production of particles and so on. And the space-like hypersurfaces where this is the surface where this is happening is the surfaces of equal phi value, meaning this value that the field has here. Okay? And that's the surface of varying intrinsic curvature, but not of varying phi. Right. So now we have to quantize the degrees of freedom that we have. We have this degree of freedom R, the scalar degrees of freedom made out of the interton field and the scalar part of the metric, and this is the purely tensor part of the metric. We also have to quantize. Remember how we do this? The two fields, the R and the H, are both obeying Klein-Gordon-type equations. But Klein-Gordon-type equations with friction terms. So we know how to handle those. We multiply our field, for example, the R field, with a suitable prefactor such that the resulting field obeys the Klein-Gordon equation without the friction term. The factor of a minus one is just a convenience factor. Throughout most of the course, we would have multiplied our field, phi, with the scale factor A of eta to obtain the field chi. This one having a friction term, that one not having a friction term in its equation of motion. So why is it that we have z of eta here rather than a of eta? Remember that the equation of motion for R is not exactly a Klein-Gordon equation. It is looking just like a Klein-Gordon equation, except that the scale factor a of eta is replaced by something that's nearly a, but not quite. It's the z of eta. Therefore, in order to turn this Klein-Gordon equation that the R obeys, in which the A is replaced by Z, into a Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term, then we have to do the same trick except as usual, except that we replace the scale factor by Z of eta. But as long as we're not too far removed from the eta inflation, Z of eta is pretty close to A of eta, as we discussed briefly last time. So all the intuition still holds, so when one field crosses the horizon, the other does as well. So the advantage is that this field U of X and eta doesn't... You have a question, right? Yes.
Did we assume the interton field was massless to get in that equation?
No, it came out. Initially, it can have a mass contributing to this overall shape here. But then when you do the perturbation expansion, when you separate the classical part of the interton field, from which is homogeneous, from its perturbation, then it turns out that the perturbations don't have a mass. All right, so this field now is designed not to have a friction term, and indeed, its equation of motion is this, which is just like the equation of motion for the field for this Klein-Gordon field that we considered previously, except that the scale factor A of eta is replaced by this new factor Z of eta. So again, we have this phenomenon that the horizon can be crossed. Namely, when this thing starts dominating over that, the omega squared, the frequency squared, changes sign, and the solution goes from oscillatory to exponential. Similarly, when we look at the tensor degree of freedom, h, it too initially has a friction term in its equation of motion. But if we multiply it with the scale factor, and this is just for decoration, so for simplicity later on, if we multiply the field with the scale factor, then we get a degree of freedom which doesn't have a friction term in its equation of motion. For the tensor modes, in fact, it's just the usual scale factor here. If you remember from the last lecture, the equation of motion for the tensor modes is exactly the usual Klein-Gordon equation. Only that the tensor modes are really not scalars, they are tensor fields, those indices running from 1 to 3. But each one of them individually obeys this Klein-Gordon equation. However, those guys are not all independent. You remember just like when we took a vector field in electromagnetism and decomposed it into a gradient field and into a curl field? That would be the analog of the curl field. It's the remainder. It's the thing that cannot be it expresses that this is the, I mean, after we write the metric as derivatives of scalars and vectors and as a remainder, and that's what this thing is. Now, in electromagnetism, when you look at the curl field, then you find out that its divergence is vanishing. And similar conditions are obeyed by the tensor degrees of freedom. First of all, these things are symmetric matrices. That cuts down on the number of degrees of freedom in there. But also we have that the trace of this matrix is always zero. And we have this feature here. We have that, no, that looks just like the divergence being zero. And that's really intuitively what it is. It's just that this is tensors and not curls. But in principle, that's what it would be. It's like the divergence is equal to zero. And when you Fourier transform this equation here, then it is that the sum over k of the ki, the momenta, times hij, k of eta is equal to zero. Now, what would that mean? What does that mean? Well, k is the vector that points in the direction in which a mode with momentum k is propagating, right? So k is always the direction in which it goes. And what we've seen here is that if you contract the k with the h, you get zero. Now, what does that mean? What does this equation mean here? Well, to see what it means, hold j fixed. Then you just have a vector left over, hi. And what this equation says is that the inner product between k and h is zero. It's saying that they're orthogonal. This vector is pointing in a direction of propagation. So that vector is orthogonal to the direction of propagation. This is why we say that hij describes transversal degrees of freedom rather than longitudinal ones. Consider, for example, an earthquake. When there's an earthquake, then there will be waves produced that propagate over thousands of kilometers. And they come in you can divide them into two categories. They are longitudinal waves, which are essentially pressure waves. So, you know, one layer presses on the other one and so on. And so the pressure wave propagates just like sound waves. But then also you can have transversal waves that are such that, you know, there's a bit of a shear, there's a bit of a rotation, let's say, of material, and that will also cause a rotation in the next layer of rock, And that will cause a rotation in the next layer and so on. So you can have transversal perturbations propagating as well. You can't have that in air or in water, but in a solid you can have that. So in a solid you can have transversally polarized waves as well. And they have no reason to propagate at the same velocity as the longitudinal ones. And in fact, they don't. So, and the propagation speed can even depend on the direction in which you have the. I gave you now the example of a circular polarization. You can have a twist like that, and that would cause a twist like that in the next layer, and so on. That will propagate. But of course, it doesn't have to be rotational at all. It could be just like that, or like this. Okay, and that is propagating then. So this sort of motion is propagating. Okay, so the HIJ describes transversal degrees of freedom, yeah? Just like tectonic shear waves. And it doesn't describe any longitudinal waves. Which shouldn't really be surprising because we are working here with massless degrees of freedom. And massless degrees of freedom propagate at the speed of light. And if something is propagating at the speed of light, it cannot have longitudinal polarization. Electrons, for example, can have a spin in the direction of propagation, but photons can't. Similarly here, we're dealing with what is called gravitons, and they, just like photons, are massless and can only have polarizations that are transversal to the direction of propagation. So HIJ actually turns out to have only 2 degrees of freedom. One can prove that from it being longitudinal, and those conditions here, namely we can write HIJ in terms of functions VK of lambda, where lambda runs from 1 to 2, describing the 2 polarization directions. Which are also often written as a cross or a plus sign, an X or a plus sign. And the polarization decomposition is this. The general tensor mode, remember this is simply the scale factor times the HIJ. This thing has this expansion here with 2 degrees of freedom, so we have 2 functions only of K. Where lambda runs from 1 to 2, the 2 polarization modes, and this is just a matrix, and we can choose the matrices so that we choose particular basis polarizations. The HIJ K of lambda are for each K 2 arbitrary but fixed matrices, and they have to obey this trace condition. Symmetry, just like what the P had to obey before, and the tracelessness, and that they are transversal only. Those conditions can be fulfilled, for example, when we choose that the epsilon ij of minus k is epsilon ij star of k. We don't have to, but it's very convenient to choose them in this way, because then we have that those functions, remember, these are the coefficients in front of the fixed polarization matrices. Those functions obey this condition, which is the same as what we had previously in the course. Vk is V minus K star. So we don't have to change any notation then. This means that the equation of motion for the tensor inhomogeneities reads like that. Instead of having a matrix full of tensor degrees of freedom, checking their symmetries, we found that there are only 2 degrees of freedom. There are only 2 independent functions, Vk1 and Vk2, that obey the Klein-Gordon equation. So the only change to what we had before previously in the course, is that we have not only functions V of K, but V of K and then lambda is 1 or 2, the 2 polarization directions. Each polarization direction is just a Klein-Gordon field. So what then about the quantum fluctuations? we want to calculate the quantum fluctuations of the intrinsic curvature or the Mukhanov variable. Remember, this was the U. Previously, it was the R variable, but the R variable obeys the Klein-Gordon equation with friction terms, so we put the Z factor in front, got the U variable, and the U variable obeys the Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term. This is the tensor degree of freedom after we multiplied with the A factor to get rid of the friction term, and after we chose the basis for the polarizations to get two of them, lambda equal 1 or 2, for the X or the plus polarization. So what we have to do is we have to solve those two equations of motion, those two Klein-Gordon equations, where the A of eta arises from the particular potential that we may choose, arises from the particular model that we may choose for how the inflaton field changes over time, how close we are to the sitter, for example. So in principle, we have everything set up. We should be able to use what we've done before and read off the results. Okay, so the task is to put hats on those, which we've done here already. So this is going to be we're going to have to solve those equations for operator valued fields, make sure that commutation relations hold, make sure that hermeticity holds. And as we did before, this reduces to solving the equations of motion for mode functions. And let us call those mode functions U tilde and V tilde, just to distinguish them from the U and the V that we had before quantization and the U hat and the V hat that we got after quantization. The U tilde and the V tilde are going to be the mode functions for the Mukhanov variable R, now called U, and the V for the tensor modes. So these guys are complex number-valued functions going into the mode decomposition of the operator fields, just as we did previously. And those mode functions, we know, are going to have to obey exactly the same Klein-Gordon equations that their operator-valued functions later would have to obey. All right, so what we have to do is solve these Klein-Gordon equations along with the Wronskian conditions. Now, what are the initial conditions going to be? Well, at early times, the k-squared term will dominate. And you see, at early times, this is not going to be all that large. And this term will still dominate, so we will still have the usual behavior, the usual oscillatory behavior of the usual oscillatory behavior even of Minkowski space. And then later on, this term will pick up, become much larger, and dominate over that. That's when the horizon crossing happened. Remember that in the case of inflation, this was, I think, H over eta, essentially. And as eta approached zero from the left, so for late times, this thing blew up, and the whole thing changed size. Okay, so the hope is that we get away with a very simple method of identifying what the vacuum state will be for our modes. Namely, we say that very early on, this would be the only term that matters, and this would be completely negligible. So if inflation lasted long enough, we just go back enough in time that the k squared term was completely dominated over the rest, and this would have been just the Minkowski equation of motion, just the Minkowski space, Klein-Gordon equation in this case, and we know what the mode function looks like during a Minkowski space phase. It's just the usual 1 over square root of omega times e to the power I omega eta. So that would fix for us the vacuum state. It would fix for us what the mode function looks like at very early times, and then all we have to do is use the Klein-Gordon equation and calculate what happens to this mode function that starts out like the Minkowski mode function. What does the Klein-Gordon equation do to it at late time? How does it look like at late times? Well, at late times, the mode K, or any fixed mode K that we may focus on, has crossed the Hubble horizon at some point. Namely, when z prime, z double prime over z in the case of the scalar degrees of freedom, or a double prime over a in the case of the tensor degree of freedom, starts to dominate over the k squared term, that's when the Hubble horizon is crossed. That's when the harmonic oscillators in these equations of motion become inverted. And that's when we have, instead of two oscillatory basis solutions, which initially we had like sine and cosine, we then have increasing and decreasing solutions, growing and decaying basis solutions. And then soon after horizon crossing, the mode function consists only of the growing solution, just the same way that we had it before. But what is the growing solution to look like at late times? Also, that argument we did carry out before, but let's just see it again. Let us look at the equations of motion. Here they are. This is the Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar degree of freedom. That's the Klein-Gordon equation for the tensor degree of freedom, for the mode functions. That's why there's a tilde on top, right? These are the mode functions. Now, at very late times, these terms dominate. This term dominates over that. That term dominates over this. So to keep things simple, let's look just at a sufficiently late time, sufficiently past horizon crossing. Then this dominates so much that we can drop the term k squared. Let's just forget about it. This thing is going to be much bigger. And here too, let's just say we are sufficiently late after horizon crossing, we can neglect that term. The advantage of this is that we can now read off what the solutions are going to look like, because the equation of motion looks so simple. Namely, remember we solved that. If you know that u tilde double prime minus z double prime over z, u tilde is equal to zero, then you can tell what the two solutions u double prime look like. And we wrote them down previously. Even before you know what exactly z of eta is or a of eta, you can tell in generality. And the reason is that the equation of motion is so simple. You see, you have z double prime, u double prime, divide the whole equation by u, then you have u double prime over u, and here you have, if you put that on the other side, is z double prime over z. Okay, it's pretty easy. You see what I mean? Let me just write it on here. So what we have is u double prime minus z double prime over z, u equals zero, okay, at late times, which is to say u double prime over u equal to z double prime over z, okay? So it's pretty obvious that u proportional z will do, okay? No matter what z of eta is, u of eta proportional z of eta will do. And obviously, this is the growing solution. Okay, because that's essentially, the z of eta is the scale factor. A of eta is the scale factor. So let's not worry about the decaying solution. It can also be calculated very easily. But the growing solution is going to be that u is proportional to z. And v is proportional to a. So u tilde is proportional to z at late eta, v tilde is proportional to a at late eta. And this means what? Well, remember, this means, first of all, that u tilde is growing tremendously. V tilde is growing tremendously. But remember, it doesn't mean that the fluctuations suddenly become very large. And that's because they don't really describe the real degrees of freedom. Remember, we had done a change of variables such that we got rid of a friction term. We have to undo this to get to the real degrees of freedom. But what are the real degrees of freedom? Well, the real degrees of freedom are this degree of freedom divided by z. And the real degree of freedom for that, the h, is this one divided by a. So that means at late times, they just approach constants. The real degrees of freedom, right? So the Vukanov variable, this r, the scalar degree of freedom, intrinsic curvature, and also the tensor degrees of freedom, their fluctuation size freezes. We just recovered a central conclusion that we had reached a few lectures ago, namely that as soon as a mode crosses the Hubble horizon, the amplitude of its fluctuations stops changing. Okay? So if a mode crosses the Hubble horizon while the Hubble horizon is very, very small, 10 to the minus 30 meters, then the amplitude of the fluctuations are very large because it's such a short wavelength that we're looking at. And then the mode has crossed the horizon and it keeps still expanding. Inflation is still going on, so its physical wavelength is increasing dramatically. But, as we have seen again here, the amplitude of its quantum fluctuation stays the same. Even when the mode is of very large wavelength, it still has the same amplitude of vacuum fluctuations as it had when it was a very, very tiny mode, a small wavelength mode. Okay? So remember what that means is that the earlier a mode crosses the horizon, or the smaller the horizon is when the mode crosses it, the larger is the amplitude that the mode has, and it keeps that amplitude when it grows in physical wavelengths up to cosmological sizes. So the smaller the Hubble parameter, the smaller the Hubble horizon, the larger the fluctuations are going to be. All right. So this is just what I said in words already. The true degree of freedom, scalar degree of freedom, intrinsic curvature, is not the U, but it's the U over Z. This not having a friction term, that having a friction term. So we have to divide this by Z. So overall, since the U at late times is proportional to Z, we have that the whole thing goes to a constant for late eta. And similarly for the tensor degrees of freedom, also going to a constant after horizon crossing. So therefore, as expected from our previous calculations, the magnitude of the mode case, or any mode case, quantum fluctuations stays constant at the value that they possess when they cross the horizon, even though in the further evolution, the mode's proper wavelength continues to increase, and to increase rapidly. And what is the size of the quantum fluctuation? Well, remember, on general grounds, we derived that the quantum fluctuations of a degree of freedom that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation are given by a factor of k to the 3 half, co-moving momentum, times the modulus squared of the mode function. So by showing that the mode function keep their modulus freeze in amplitude, we showed that the size of the quantum fluctuations, the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations of that mode, freeze in amplitude. Now our goal, obviously, is to calculate these things. How big are they? For that purpose, we cannot simply reuse our previous calculation with the Hankel functions. Remember, we assumed the sitter inflation, and then we said, oh, the sitter inflation is great. We know what the scale factor is in terms of the moving of the conformal time. It was just A of eta is h over eta, or minus h over eta. Very simple. We were able to solve the mode functions and so on in terms of Hankel functions, and that was that. But now we see that in the realistic scenario, where we are looking at the interplay between an inflaton field and the metric, we have to work with this variable r, the intrinsic curvature variable. And this thing we can only use if we are not doing the sitter. We have to be a little bit away from the sitter space. And of course, physically too, we assume that we have a slow roll. The sitter would be constant, right? Because v of phi is a roll of the cosmological constant. So the sitter space would be simply this. Inflation goes on forever. And we have a little bit of a slope there. We must have a little bit of slope because otherwise inflation would never end. Okay, so the sitter is ruled out because V of phi, the temporary cosmological constant, would be a permanent cosmological constant. And in any case, our perturbation, our assumptions that went into the perturbation theory don't allow for exact the sitter space. So in order to be realistic, let us introduce some parameters that describe this kind of scenario and that describe how far away we are from the sitter. we don't know what exactly the potential V of phi is. But it's clear that what will happen in the inflationary scenario depends on the slope. That would be the first derivative of the potential. Ultimately, even the second derivative might play a role in how fast this thing rolls down and so on. Remember that a mode that crosses the horizon while V of phi is still large will end up with larger quantum fluctuations than a mode that crosses the horizon when V of phi is a bit smaller. Because if V of phi is smaller, the Hubble length is larger and the fluctuations of the field are already smaller when they are frozen in. So it does matter what exactly the shape is of the potential there. And it is of great interest to try to reconstruct what the shape of the potential is. So what we can do is we can parameterize the potential in terms of derivatives. And these are called the so-called slow roll parameters. remember one thing to understand those definitions, namely that here's the potential. The square root of the potential is the Hubble parameter. 1 over that is the Hubble radius. So it's the same thing, really, whether we describe the shape of the potential in terms of derivatives of V or its square root, which is H. Same thing, right? So traditionally, what one does is to parameterize the potential in terms of the derivatives of the square root of V. It just turns out to be easier to work with. So let us look at the derivatives of H, of the Hubble parameter with phi. Epsilon of phi is the most important slow roll parameter given by this ratio here. And then the second derivatives and the third derivatives, or combinations in the second and the third derivatives, are also sometimes considered. But this is the main one because it gives you the overall slope. Now, the simplest case, the case with slope equals zero, we already solved. That was the Sitter space. We have to do one better than that. So what is the simplest slow roll case for which we can give a solution? Well, the simplest case of slow roll for which we can give a solution is that where epsilon of phi is a constant. In this case, we have that a constant is equal to epsilon of phi, but epsilon of phi is this. Remember, that was the definition of the slow roll parameter just here, h prime over h. So when the first slow roll parameter is a constant, then this would be the scenario. But that means that h prime over h is a constant. And remember that this prime is not a derivative with respect to the time. It's a derivative with respect to phi. Yes?
Sorry. Could you go back up here for a second?
Yes.
When you have, just on the side there, I keep going, the comments on the right.
Yes.
With the top one, how do the time derivatives of phi end up coming out of that?
You see, the slope will determine how fast the phi is rolling.
Sure.
So it's not obvious, you have to do some calculations.
Okay.
But the slope of it determines how fast it is going. Right, so remember that you can think of H as being nearly the same as V, the potential, right? Because, you know, H is really the square root of V. Right? So H, V is big means H is big, etc. So epsilon of phi is really just something like the derivative of V with respect to phi, really the slope of the curve. It's not exactly the derivative of V, it's the derivative of H with respect to phi. And it's not just the derivative, you normalize it by dividing by H. See, this way, it just comes out more conveniently. Well, and then let's not worry about these parameters for the moment. Let's just enforce that this is constant, and then we will find out what these other guys are. So the simplest solvable case is where this first lower parameter is a constant. But if it is constant, then it means that h differentiated with respect to phi divided by h of phi is a constant, but that means that h as a function of phi is exponential. It's this one. Okay? But h is the square root of phi. Okay? So we got the potential now as a function of phi. Namely, we got that the potential is a constant times phi. E to the power of a constant times phi. So this doesn't mean exponential expansion at all. It just means that the potential itself has exponential shape. Right? So you would have something like this, for example. You see, I mean, I drew this curve here so dramatically, but actually a lot of other potentials would work as well. Even phi to the 4 might work in order to get an inflationary scenario. Apparently phi to the 4 is already ruled out. It's not matching precisely enough the experimental data. But in order to get the inflationary behavior, you could use phi to the 4. Even phi squared will do. But here, we work with this. We get an exponential curve. The main point is that the inflaton field will roll. So then I leave it to you as an exercise to find out what the value of S is. I mean, please, I think that will be very easy. I'm sorry, I shouldn't even ask that. Okay, then... Yeah, but then make that an exercise, find out what the other slow rows parameters are. And it turns out they are the same, actually. And you see they're nicely designed so that this comes out. Okay. So in this case, it turns out that the expansion rate is polynomial, no longer exponential. The potential is exponential, but not the expansion. The expansion comes out to be A of t, where t is the proper time of freely floating galaxies, the scale factor is some constant times t to the power of 1 over c, c being that constant over there. That constant we choose the slow roll parameter. Just a moment. And you see that if c is large, then we have a large derivative. We have a large slope. If c is small, we are closer to the sitter, right? You see, if c is small, the slope is small. H prime is small. H prime is like the derivative of v with respect to phi. The h is like v. It's just the square root of it. So if h has little slope, v has little slope. C is small. And c small means, therefore, if v has little slope, we are close to the sitter case, where v of phi is a constant. Okay, so that's the case we have to watch out for. Okay, c small means getting closer to the sitter. Now, the expansion rate is, however, polynomial. It's this. We don't have e to the something t. We have t to the power of 1 over c. And what you see now is that it's a universe which is expanding at a polynomial rate. But if c, this overall parameter, is really small, then that rate is really dramatic. It's not exponential, but if c is a very, very small number, this ratio is very, very large, and it expands with a huge power. And you see, this is not, you can't continuously go to the sitter space here. Because as c goes to zero, this doesn't turn into an exponential. It just turns into t to the infinity. Okay, so we don't have the sitter as a smooth limiting case, and we shouldn't, because we know that in the precise sitter case, our whole perturbation theory breaks down. Okay, so we get close to the sitter space, as close as we want to, but we can't really take the limit, and we don't want to take the limit for getting the sitter space. Now, what about going from proper time coordinates from the proper time coordinate of co-moving observers that sit in a galaxy and use their wristwatches, to the conformal time, which is very useful because all our formalism was done in conformal time. Well, a libitory is an exercise to calculate the conformal time. After all, you just have to solve a little differential equation to get what A of eta is. Just the same way we did it for the Sitter space, we'll also work here. And what we get is that A of eta is, again, just minus 1 over eta h, as we had it before. There's just a little decorative extra factor there. But for small epsilon, it doesn't really make much of a difference. If epsilon is really small and we're really close to the Sitter, then yes, this turns into the expression that we had for the Sitter, just because the second term goes away. Notice also that the range of the variable eta is still as it was in the case of the Sitter. Eta takes any arbitrary negative value. Very, very large negative value means the early past. And as eta approaches zero from the left, we reach future infinity. Now the mode equations. Now we can write down the mode equations explicitly for this so-called power law inflation. Well, for this, let's start with the scalar degrees of freedom. First of all, we need this variable here, the z of eta. For that, we have to calculate a squared over a prime times phi naught prime, etc. All of this stuff can be done explicitly now in the power law case. And therefore, we can also calculate the term z double prime over z. And if you plug it all in, you obtain that the mode function has to obey this equation of motion. So we have a nu squared minus 1/4 over eta squared. Again, very similar to the De Sitter case. In the De Sitter case, we had a fixed number up here, and now it's variable. It depends on what our slow roll coefficient C is. We have a number nu here, and that nu is 3/2 plus C over 1 minus C. So what happens if C is chosen very, very small, so that we are very close to the Sitter space? Well, in this case, this term can be dropped. We have a 3/2 over here. We have a 9/4 minus 1/4 is 8/4, so it's a factor of 2 that we have up here, and that's exactly the Sitter case that we have. But when we have power law, then it's not exactly the Sitter, but it's not much of a difference either. So now we can still solve this with Hankel functions, except that instead of having a 3/2 here, as in the case of the Sitter, these Hankel functions are going to have a nu in here. That's why we define this variable nu in this particular way. The reason being that this equation of motion has that solution in terms of the Hankel functions with nu occurring here and also over there. So these are the Hankel functions of the first kind of order nu. And, we know how these things behave at very early times. They've got to be sine and cosine-like. And then at late times, we know that there's going to be a decaying solution, and there's going to be a solution that goes just like the scale factor, this one that we calculated over here. But it's nice to have the exact thing, too. So what then is the behavior after horizon crossing? So after horizon crossing, what do you do? Well, you look at the value of the Hankel function at late times, at eta being very small, approaching zero from the negative side, and you take into account that you have this prefactor as well, and you find that this approaches a particular behavior. And the behavior after horizon crossing is this. And you see, it's not exactly constant in time now, because there's still a little bit of a dependence on eta in this. Well, actually, to be precise, even if we had done this for the sitter space, we would have a dependence on eta here. But the dependence on eta would be just a 1 over eta. See, because nu would be 3/2. The sitter is the case of nu being 3/2. Remember, let's just go up here again. See, phi going to 0 means nu is 3/2. So our mode function, and this is already the mode function which is such, this is the solution which is such that it turns into the Minkowski solution at early time. So it's the correct one at late time. This one at late times after horizon crossing looks like this. Nu would be 3/2 in the case of the sitter. Then we have minus 3/2 plus 1/2, that's minus 1. So we have a behavior like 1 over eta here, which means that u, the mode function, explodes, grows large, like 1 over eta after the horizon crossing. But that's what we should expect, namely that u is proportional to z, the scale factor. But then u is not the physical degree of freedom. We have to divide by the scale factor, and that makes it go, that makes it freeze its amplitude again. So therefore, the magnitude of the intrinsic curvature fluctuations after horizon crossing becomes this, where we simply evaluated that expression here at horizon crossing. And, please just check that. You see, this cancellation of the mode growing and then the growth being divided by the scale factor to give you a constant is not going to take place exactly in the case of power law inflation. In the case of the sitter, we had that the size of the fluctuations was exactly frozen after horizon crossing. Now it's no longer exactly frozen because this is no longer going to be exactly 1 over eta, because this mu is no longer going to be exactly 3/2, but the scale factor is going like 1 over eta. Right? Okay. But the difference is going to be very small. Okay, so what we obtain is that the scalar degrees of freedom, this mix between the inflatons fluctuations and the metric fluctuation, the scalar part of the metric fluctuation, I'm going to have that amplitude here, and you know, just to get these gamma factors and so on, you just have to look up the solution to this differential equation here. And by the way, the exact prefactors, of course, like this prefactor here, the gamma of 3/2. That, of course, you can never get out of just solving the Klein-Gordon equation. You know where that comes from? An overall prefactor for the mode function? What would fix that? Isn't the overall prefactor would be fixed by the Wronskian condition? Or, easier, just make sure that at very early times it turns into the Minkowski solution with the right prefactor. Okay, so this is the size of the fluctuations here. And what you see is that, interestingly, we notice that since h prime must be small, remember, that means slow roll. H prime is small. H prime is the slope. It's like v prime because, I mean, like dv by d phi. H is very similar to that because h is simply the square root of v. So if that has to be small because of slow roll, h better also be small. Right? So, namely, we know that these guys are small, observationally. Okay, so this is now I'm making an important argument, something that you may hear all over again when you attend talks about CMB fluctuations, tensor modes, seeing gravitational waves in the CMB, and so on. My point is this. H prime has to be small in order to have slow roll. This is small. Therefore, H has to be small. Okay? And the smaller this slope is, the smaller the slope in the slow roll is, the smaller h prime is, the smaller, therefore, h has to be, right? For this overall still to come out small. So the conclusion from this, from reading this, is that small slow roll, first slow roll parameter, if the roll is small, if we are close to the sitter, then h has to be small. But that's going to be important because h is what determines the size of the tensor fluctuations that everybody's looking for. Okay? So if the slope is small, if it's close to the sitter, then we will expect not to see much of tensor fluctuations. The reason is this. So I just gave you away already the outcome of the calculation for the tensor modes, because there we will see that the amplitude of the tensor modes will be proportional to h. The amplitude of the scalar modes is proportional to h squared over h prime. So in principle, a small h prime is fine. It's in the denominator, but it implies a small h, and that will be killing for the, it will be killing the tensor mode. So in the tensor mode case, this is the equation of motion. Then we obtain, when we calculate a double prime over a, this thing for power law inflation, we obtain that behavior here. And when we calculate that explicitly, we find that a double prime over a in terms of eta is this. Again, just a little algebra there. So now we see that, that's also going to be just a factor of 2 in the case of the sitter. I mean, this is 3/2, right? It's 9/4 minus 1/4, so that's just 8/4, that's 2, that's just the usual de Sitter case, as we should expect. Okay, now, so the mode equation is again solved by the Hankel functions, and the tensor fluctuation spectrum now comes out to be this here. Okay, and the key thing to read off from that, apart from that you recover a de Sitter-like case, in the case when u goes to 3/2, a key thing to read off from that is that it's proportional to h. Okay? That's the point. If h is big, if the exponential expansion during inflation was very rapid, h is very big, which is to say that the Hubble horizon is very small. So the modes cross the horizon very early when they're very, very small. Then we have a chance to see tensor fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. But for that, h has to be big. Now, our present situation experimentally is that we have measured this to be of the order 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. And now we are guessing what those things are. How do we get 10 to the minus 5 from that? Is it going to be small h and small h prime or big h and big h prime? We don't know yet. But we hope that it's the case of big H prime. Because in this case, a big H means we're going to have big H over here, and we're going to see tensor fluctuations. If, however, we are unlucky, then we get this ratio of 10 to the minus 5 for small h prime, small h. Then it could be really very small h prime and very small h, in which case the tensor fluctuations here just won't show up. In fact, we can already put a bound on this ratio there because we haven't seen them yet, the tensor fluctuations. We can already put a bound on how big h could possibly have been. So, as we discussed the last time already, the hunt is on to see those things. And from the observation of the scalar fluctuations, which manifest themselves, if you remember, in temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. From the observation of those, we try to infer what that ratio is. We get right away the ratio here, but only the ratio. And if in addition to that, we can also measure h prime then we can tell what age would have been, and that tells us how much of tensor fluctuations we should see. If we can pull this off, then we have a really tight constraint on inflation. We could really make a prediction. This many tensor modes have to be there if the inflationary scenario, as we discussed it, holds true. One inflaton field behaving this way. Now, is there a way to get a hold of H prime? How could we experimentally see this? By just observing the fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background. Well, there is, because remember that this equation depends on K. Right? So remember that a strong slope means that modes which cross the horizon later cross a larger horizon, because the potential will have dropped already, and the temporary cosmological constant is no longer so big, the Hubble horizon is no longer so small, modes that cross the Hubble horizon late, therefore have fluctuations frozen in, which are not all that big. So if we can observe a change in the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations from over the wavelength spectrum, then we can infer something about that slope, and that should tell us something about how this ratio comes about, namely how big H is, and it gives us a prediction of the tensor mode. And so far, as far as I know, experimentally, there is evidence for the slope, but it's not very tight. And so all we can say is that there is a it's still possible that we see tensor modes, but it's borderline. If we are lucky, we will see tensor modes. But it seems that the slope is really very small relative, so that we don't expect to see many tensor modes because H prime is small, so H would be small. Okay, so much for inflation. Any questions? You remember the next lecture on Tuesday is going to be about unrelated things. Okay. So, any questions about inflation?
First read. First read.
Oh, okay.
Then you get
Is there a way to rule 5 the function of t?
Yeah. Did I not give it to you somewhere?
I don't think so, but it seems necessary to find.
Yeah, but you know, these calculations, you know, let me show you where these ones. How to get from this to that, and then the power law solution and expressing everything as functions of phi and then expressing it as function of time and so on. Are in the text by Riotto.
Thanks. In the speaker.
So, when we are not taking any force action,
so you need those equations that
are